You're listening to part 2 of episode 587 of Unwelcome Guests. We take a music break. This is an FCC censored version of God's Country by Clayton Blizzard.
Getting money, you know, if you start spending all this money. that's how they get you.
Now, thanks to Clayton Blizzard for that music recording. We're now going to hear the audio of Ivan Illich's contribution to a 1984 conference on water held in Dallas, Texas. I've edited some of the Q&A and removed some of the hesitations and background noise to try and improve general comprehensibility. If you wish to download the original, you can do so from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/587. Now, as is quite common with Ivan Illich, I don't find this easy to understand what he's saying. Now, on a few occasions, he talks about HWO. I assume he's talking about H2O. And this is just a slip of the tongue. In any case, I've found that it's rewarded multiple listenings, and I'm starting to understand the points that he's making about the materialistic notions of hygiene, just as you think if you live in the West. Well, of course, we need toilet paper. You can't be hygienic without toilet paper. Well, that turns out not to apply in Bangladesh, where people manage to be quite hygienic without toilet paper. Ditto chairs in Korean restaurants or cutlery here in Bangladesh. A lot of the fundamental ways that things have to be done in people's minds turn out not to be fundamental at all. And our idea about how we should be using water in order to keep healthy and keep smelling nice turns out to be quite far removed from what the historical evidence tells us.
Now, when we contacted him about coming to Dallas for this conference, he replied on the phone that he had just happened that morning to be riding on the original waters of forgetfulness and memory, Nemoizene. And so, to give us the mythic beginnings of water and dreams, I present to you Ivan Illich.
Thank you, Gail Thomas. In 3 days, you have made me feel at home in Dallas, Texas. The next thing which happened, you forgot to say, Bob Sardello's paper, The Metaphors of the City of Cancer, Heart Attack, and Herpes Genitalis, arrived. And this paper has certainly inspired what I'm going to say. And I'm trying to continue our conversation as if we were still comfortable sitting in the ranch. And some of the people who have not been with us at the ranch, just sit here and listen in on our conversation. I'm really continuing to speak where Tom Moore this morning stopped when he said that HWO has become a metaphor for the city child, for what water was. I want to deal with the great ambiguity which lies there. In 1616, William Harvey announced to the London College of Physicians that he had discovered the circulation of the blood. That's well known. When he published his theory 12 years later, in the Exercitatio Anatomica de Motu Cordis, and so on, it constituted a major contribution towards the transformation of flesh and blood into that social construct which today we call the human body. The mercantilist conception of wealth, which depends on the flow and circulation of money, and the medical conception of health, which depends on the circulation of blood, are both essential to the constitution of that new kind of human being who has come into existence, whom people like René Dumont call Homo economicus. It's a new type of biped. It took another 100 years, 120 years, until a group of British architects began to speak of the City of London according to the very same paradigm, and several times refer in their writings to the immortal Harvey, the model for the architect. For them, the city was perceived as an entity that lives on the incessant circulation of water, according to this unprecedented image of a habitat. Water must constantly flow into the city and, with as little delay as possible, must flow out of it, carrying the city's wastes and sweat, urines and excrements. This new architectonic, fundamentally structuring conception of the city, which will stagnate and rot until water washes it day and night, took a further century until it acquired the semblance of naturalness which it held, I'm not saying into the 80s, but certainly through the 60s of our century. We live today in cities, wherever the world is developed. This is a sign, an index of development, where 42%, it's a very, almost a magical number, 42% of the total water pumped into the city for households is used in order to dilute excrements. The amount of money which you pump into the city to achieve this is half of that which it is in the United States, in England. The percentage used for this particular purpose, and I'm not speaking of further 12 to 15% for washing floors and clothes, remains the same. As used as we are to flush toilets and blood transfusions, we easily forget the creative genius of the men who invented these constructs. Harvey created something previously unthinkable, namely blood as a medium of circulation, and water as the lifeblood of the city that cleanses the city, created by Chadwick and Ward and their colleagues, is just as new. And just as Harvey's blood cannot vivify that microcosm which physicians of the type of Hippocrates or Galen or Paracelsus saw when they faced human flesh and blood, but the circulating blood called for a recasting of flesh and blood into the body, whose history Michel Foucault has attempted to write, so Chadwick's circulating water calls forth a new perception of the city. Like the body, the city also has become a system of pipes. I just had the wonderful experience that I asked 7 people if I couldn't walk with them across this place, which is built for walking. All 7 had to drive across it on some very complicated channels which lead from over there over here. They are all here. No, one couldn't come. I want to call attention to the metaphorical degradation of water, which is the result of its perception as a piped and metered cleaning fluid that is needed constantly to wash the city from its evil smells. Since this contribution today has to fit into 30 minutes, and since this meeting is not concerned with the water as a natural resource, a commodity, a fluid playground, and a lure for development, but principally as a metaphor, I cannot go into the full development of this wash, H2O washing device, which the city needs, but can only focus on contrasting menothione with H2O. The water in the faucet constantly flows back and forth across the city's limits. This has changed, of course, in the 70s with the water cleaning kidneys, which we construct next to cities. With the faucet, also the sewer began to flow. Old sewers did not flow. Historically, it's a mistake to believe that sewers flowed. In Indo-Germanic languages, water did not flow principally from a city's point of view. Water itself is a limit. It separates this world from the other, the past from the next. This is the world of the dead, this other world. And Indo-Germanic myth has no fixed location for the other world. For some traditions, the other world lies below the earth. For others, on a star, in the sky, on Mount Olympus, on an island, far west. But for all these Indo-Germanic traditions, the other world is the realm beyond a body of water, beyond an ocean, a lake, or a stream. You can be carried across by a ferryman, but more often it is a river you must ford yourself. And what lies beyond these waters in myth, these waters that separate us from the dead, in all this myth is a spring which the river feeds. You can find this everywhere. In Greek, the name of this river-fed spring is that also that of the first goddess, Mnemosyne. Bruce Lincoln has shown that at bottom, Greek, Indic, Nordic, and Celtic funeral geographies are nourished by the same mythical hydrology. The picture that emerges is as follows. On the way to the other world, the traveler has to cross a flowing river which washes his memories from his feet. But these memories are not destroyed. The river carries them back to a spring where they bubble up again. Privileged ones, and I thank you for sharing your privilege with us, privileged ones gain access to this spring and can drink from its waters. The epical singer, the prophet, some heroes, some seers, returning from a trip to the realm of the dead, from a dream, I just thought from Northumberland, from a mystical journey, they bring these memories back to a world which needs them, for whom they constitute the greatest gift. The dead have no need for their memories, but their memories are of immense value for the living. Not the dead depend on the living, but the living depend on the dead. They depend on the memories from the bubbling pool of Mnemosyne. But the river Lethe, the stream of forgetfulness, washes from those who cross it. That river carries and nourishes the clear pond of remembrance, which is a community's greatest treasure, and which was born at the beginning of time, because when heaven still lay in the arms of earth, those who know very old Greek poetry will see that I'm just putting old poems together, when the heaven still lay in the arms of earth, when Uranus still shared the bed with the broad-hipped Gaia, the Titans came into being, and with them Mnemosyne. In the hymn of Hermes, she's called the mother of the Muses, the firstborn of all women. Hesiod remembers her flowing hair when Zeus lies in bed with her to engender her daughters. From her comes the muse of enthusiasm, but also that of forgetfulness. She's the godmother, not the real mother, but somehow the one standing by, of Apollon, the only god who cannot forget, who is himself drenched with the knowledge of the source. Mnemosyne appears as the Titans, as the social birth of water. Water, the cosmic element, here in this story becomes the source of remembrance and of culture. And at the same time that it becomes social, it acquires the features of woman. This image of water in turn fades. This I would not like to forget in our discussions, with the transition from oral to written culture, from archaic to a classical town in Greece. Memory is a bubbling pool beyond the river of forgetfulness. Memory is a source nourished by the river that strips the dead of their encumbrance. Memory, as the mother of Hermes Apollo, does not fit the world of fountain and book. And the merchant on the market of Athens at the time Aristotle lived. As the trader becomes a merchant and water is brought in by aqueduct, this happens probably more so in Rome, and the sources of tradition become the book, the pool of remembrance fed by the river of forgetfulness recedes into the mysteries, becomes secret knowledge. Mnemosyne receives no cult at all. The term is used henceforth as a mere personification of a new faculty which distinguishes the new city dweller from the old, the faculty of memory which each one now carries written in his heart, like a tablet, a page, or a slab. Plato, with his magnificent ambiguity to the letters, tells the story of Ammon, the king of Egypt, who tried to refuse the gift of this memory that dries up the power of remembrance, as he said, that Thoth wanted to bring to him from Heliopolis. This particular transformation of water in social imagination must be studied and recognized if we want to shake off the spell that a confusion between archaic and classic Mnemosyne and water so easily throw over our reflections. And for this, I think one way, simply because I happen to be somewhat competent on it, I tell the story, to study how water changed, it became a cleaning fluid. I want to speak exactly about water as the removal of stench. The complaint about the city being a dirty place has a history which goes back into antiquity. You might remember that on the forum there was a special place with people sitting in little tents for these smaller discussions of somebody having been hit by a night pot thrown down on the city, on the street. But the obsession with the city as a dirty place, as a place that has to be constantly deodorized, is clearly part and parcel not of antiquity. There might be some places where the city was particularly clean, but of the Enlightenment. And the obsession is not primarily, this Enlightenment obsession is not primarily of a visual, but of olfactory origin. The obsession with the city as an evil-smelling place is due to a profound transformation in the perception of smell that happened on the continent as well as in England during the mid-decades of the 18th century. We begin to know something about this part of history, the history of the perceptions of smell. The last 25 years have seen a growing interest by historians in the transformation of sense perceptions. Building on Norbert Elias and his teacher Lefebvre, Robert Mandrou in 1961 was the first to call attention to the primacy of touching and smelling and hearing in early Europe, which only slowly gave way to our primacy of the eye, which we now take for granted. Value. And the Sioux of Paris is the city's chronic disease and wound. Any attempt to stuff more valuable night soil, I'm repeating Balzac, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not inventing this, down the drain meant increasing the unimaginable horrors which inevitably underlie a city in its cloaks. The opposite colonialist positive view on the sewer is taken in 1871 by the Prince of Wales, just before he became King Edward VII. If he were not the prince, he said, the next preference would be to be a plumber because of the great good this does to humanity. In the Royal Society of the Arts, Hellinger exhorts his fellow craftsmen, hydraulic engineers. Quote, lying there in these strong arms of yours, slumbering in your hardened muscles, resting in the well-trained fingers and educated hands, lies the health of our Leviathan city. Jules Verne in France begins to speak of the inversion of what yesterday Scott Dupre has told us about the city, about the city's father's task, the government's task being is to bring water into the city. The principal task of the government is to evacuate the city. The conveniences of sewage and plumber was installed as a special feature at the Crystal Palace in the World Exposition of 1851, and 14% of the visitors paid twice as much as they paid for entrance into the exposition for its use. This, I quote, convenience suited to the advantages of advanced civilization, was perfected in the 70s by a foundry owner, Mr. Crapper, and the water flush valve was patented under the name of Anus Mirabilis. You can look it up in the patent records. But was later on advertised as WC, which became an international word of the English language, and contributed to the presence of a British style during the first half of this century all over the world. The last city on the eastern seaboard, which made it by ordinance obligatory, was Baltimore in 1912. From the Treaty of Versailles to the report of the Club of Rome, the faucet in the kitchen and the flush toilet in the apartment were considered as evolutionary complements of the human body. Then set the period in of criticism. First of all, it was demonstrated that wherever, and this is true also during the last 20 years, and nobody wanted to have it true when the State Department moved into development policies, wherever you pipe in water into the apartment, inevitably There are such ratios you can find. Water consumption per family per capita goes up by a factor of somewhere between 30 and 50. Draining water is much more expensive. Much of the city lake discussion goes about this. It's much more expensive. Therefore, it comes to the poor only 20 or 30 years after water has been installed, which means that the water, which traditionally was absorbed 1/50th part, 2%, by the building site of the house, from now on creates a new kind of miasm. Everywhere in the world, under all circumstances, the research, finally of a few open-eyed public health researchers, shows the increase of intestinal disease increases with water piping into the houses among the poor. Among the rich during the last century, it also increased water seepage into the drinking supply, and therefore a different kind of disease. These diseases become class-specific. Then came the ecological criticism. I am not concerned with either of the two. I want to call to your attention for reflection, for discussion, that to, in which deeper way I understand what Mr. Moore said this morning about water. H2O is a totally different substance than the water of which the poetry just dealt, of the real problem and challenge we have for the city child, not for us privileged who sit here and have access to all kinds of poetry, to speak about water, the water which waters the imagination and dreams, in a society where the child has only an experience of a metered substance, half of which goes into diluting waste. That's all what I wanted to do as a contribution to this meeting. Thank you for your patience. Any questions? I am very happy to answer any questions you want. On fact, on interpretation, on... Yeah.
The first question asks whether Illich had any ideas about changing people's values so that they behaved in a different way.
Well, I'm addressing intellectuals, I assume, with certain civic responsibilities. I would like this group of intellectuals to, on the basis of what I've just told, with a little bit more perspective, to move away from the naturalness of the WC, which means a tremendous challenge for these towers you described today about these glass towers. You might not be able to build those, to afford those. I would like people who are here to reflect on the extraordinary newness involved in using half of the household water, 2/3 of the household water, for the dilution of 1% of as much, or a fraction of 1% of as much human waste. I want to call attention, forgive me to be very practical, I saw a little bottle standing in the bathroom at the, to one of my colleagues, what is this? This was the bathroom, our bathroom there. Obviously, because it must be very smelly, notwithstanding the excellent watering, I'm speaking of the farm, was, I've counted them in the bathroom which I was supposed to use, 7 little flacons, which have as a purpose, which emanate a gas which deadens my nose. They always say they take the smell out of the ambiente. No, not at all. They deaden the nose. They are powerful drugs to deaden your nerve ends. I would like to have, forgive me, it's very strange that smell has become something which you may not even discuss. I would like that we begin not to allow our fear of smell to stop us from considerations of alternatives. There are such technical alternatives. But they influence enormously how you consider space arrangements. Most of our good architects would suddenly find out that they only support, in fact, what they consider natural. Water basically is a washing medium, and when you take 1% of it, it's not very much, and it cost, doesn't cost very well, to pump it around fountains, to humor the imagination. I might there was another. Yes, ma'am.
The next question is also inaudible due to being off mic, but clearly concerns a historical role of excrement as a useful fertilizer.
In my home, at least, probably in yours too, there came a man and paid something for the privilege to take away our excrements. This valuable thing is now becoming a major problem. Your whole lake discussion is tied up with it. Feasibility studies can be done on several levels. On the level in which you do it, as far as I can see, you just reconfirm basic assumptions about water and about the human body, which have been created during the last 20, 30 years. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to ask you, why the length span? Why did it take so long to arrive at that point and such a short time to get to where we are now?
You know my aversion to mix, from my point of view, imprudently, interpretation of historical perceptions with the attempt to present history. Depending on where I begin with the interpretation, I do have my own preferred interpretation, and that is that it has something to do with the attempt to get rid of any memory of yesterday's hamburger has nothing to do with Lethe, with Lethe, with the river Lethe, which washes away the dead's memories in order to bring them back to bubble up as poetry. It's precisely the contrary. It is an inversion of our perception, of language and ourselves, of soul and body. This is my interpretation. And this happens, that's the reason why I want to speak about the history of the human body, somewhere in the period between 1760 and 1820, 1830, during that century which, let's say, begins 1740 and ends 1880. You see that this is nothing else but one chapter of history of the body. Yes.
The next questioner asked, in light of our misconceptions about hygiene, what is become of us?
More than that, I'm concerned with the seeming naturalness, exigency of human decency, of basic hygiene connected with the kind of life we live, being totally unaware that not only can a decreasing percentage of the world's population share in this perception of what is natural to our body, but by pumping always more water into our few cities, water is here just one symbol, HWO, this piped commodity, we make, and making the WC, for instance, into a must, we degrade those people who don't use it. Just as we create a world of illiterates by insisting on compulsory literacy, we create a world of dirty, smelly people by insisting on deodorizing our milieus, and then in the richest and best constructed places, having to desensitize the nose so it doesn't smell how badly these apparatuses work. But these are fundamentals when we want to discuss water. They may not be touched because those people here who are professionally building professions would be exposed as fools. You see, we support each other to say that they do the job, then they don't do the job. We have to desensitize the noses. Well, we could right away go and operate on the noses. There should be a sterilization of the nose possible. Yes, sir.
The next speaker announced that he'd been working for the last 3 years on a history of perfumery.
And so, really, it'll come out next fall, but I have some opinions. I really feel that the way that we should move is not to become like the European ancestors were, very unaware and unsensitive to hideous odors. And this is a European prejudice, because the Indians bathe many times a day, the Japanese the same way, the Chinese, the Islamic people,
you are right,
are very strong on bathing and no bodily odor. So it's a European amnesia not to be sensitive to the ugliness of feces and rotting bodies, etc. And I feel that we should go the other way. We should become more sensitive. And there are other ways than just to return to primitivity and not to notice the odor of feces, etc. They can be removed without the great waste of water.
I have never suggested that we should go back.
Oh, no.
I'm simply saying the way in which we went forward is a very funny one. I'm not saying at all that we should go back.
I don't think it was funny. I think it was very reasonable, especially with the germ theory of disease, which
was as wrong as as fundamentally wrong, because wherever we use that water, we increase the germs. Yeah, but just look at the more recent studies of epidemiology.
I am not convinced that the more we wash, the more we increase the germ.
No, yeah. But the more water we pump through the system, not the more we wash, but the more volume of H2O we pump through the system, the more we increase germs. It is very funny when I live usually several months a year in Mexico in a village, when I come to the city, and this, I have the impression, either because of age, or because of reflection, or because of a fact, I don't know which one, these cities stink increasingly. Mm. Of a stench which is of a subtle, of a deadening kind, which you do not perceive anymore. These air-conditioned rooms. Yes.
Henry Thoreau said, once you get warm, after that you only get overheated. That's something about energy. Also, once you're clean, after that you get sterile.
That is a major concern. There are several treatises about up until 1810, but 1740, about the danger, particularly for men, to wash the seminal odor from their bodies, which gives them exactly their vigor, which is not an attraction, but which is also their vigor, for which it is necessary. So it's very close to the time of Thoreau. The tradition is there. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. What has happened to the positive feelings of the natural odors of the body?
Well, these natural odors of the body, I hear in European history, for the first time in a very high elitist, scholarly milieu, around 1780, we become very important about 1820 and 1830. They are in fact used, I think, to define also the domestic domain of the woman. The two things go together. We should not overlook the rather regressive way in which talk about the typical odor of the well-washed lady of the house has helped to establish the dream of the private home. Now, I'm speaking of European history during this period which I'm dealing with. I'm not saying that there might be people, God knows where, and also perhaps here formally, who perceived very strongly odors. But the fascination with sexual odors and the anthropological treatises about them, which end up then with the famous passage from Freud in the footnote on odor, on the sense of smell, are typical for the years 1880, 1870 to 1890. I'm not saying that I know where we should go. I can only tell you where we come from. And I'm not telling you how it smelled. I only tell you how people perceived that it smelled. Anybody else?
Then what did your statement, odors of sanctity, represent?
This is something on which I am competent. You see, at the beginning of the 12th century, about 10 to 15% of all values transported as merchandise through the roads of Europe were bones. Bones of so-called martyrs and saints, which were very important. They were important as energy suppliers today. And you recognized these bones by their characteristic odor. I can only say that this is what the sources tell me. Stealing bones of saints is very dangerous, because as soon as you open the grave, the odor of sanctity, quoting a passage from the merchants from Bari who went to steal St. Nicholas in Antioquia, invade the city and wake everybody up with their sweetness. I know that there was one man, a bishop of Milan, who refused to feel that odor, and that was a world of Europe-wide discussion, what's wrong with that bishop. So people felt something. If it was chemical or psychological, that I leave aside. By the end of that century, not only had the smell of sanctity decreased very much, but Rome claimed to have a unique God-given power to distinguish the bones of saints from bones of non-saints, bored holes into them and put papal seals on them. Now, this is very far away, right? But if I could tell people,
200 years from now, about our discussion on odors and deodorization and odor of the city and the quantity of water related to odors, etc., they probably would feel just as wonder as much as you wonder today about my odor of sanctity in the 12th century.
Now, it's an interesting example that Illich chose to highlight the importance of the bones of the saints to medieval Europe. He himself was very clear on the unsustainability of modern energy use practices, and he wrote a book, I think it was late 70s, he wrote a book called Energy and Equity, in which he looked at, for example, the average speed which people travel in a motor car, not only looking at issues such as traffic jams, but factoring in the amount of hours you have to pay to get the car fixed, the amount of work you have to do to buy the petrol, to run the car, and to buy the car in the first place. And I think his conclusion was, even disregarding accidents and the concomitant lack of mobility and loss of life as a result, your average overall speed of transport by motor vehicle was about the same as walking speed. Certainly the bones of the saints don't seem like much of a priority to most modern listeners. Could it be the case that some years in the future people will listen to the arguments about peak oil in the 21st century and shrug their shoulders saying, what were those people on about? What possessed them to spend the last of the easily available fossil fuels creating new nuclear weapons or aircraft carriers or superhighways or mega malls? Here in Bangladesh, electricity use is less during winter, but most days we have several power cuts every day, and life goes on. I appreciate in the US there may be several systems, such as electronic payment systems or other complex apparatus, which wouldn't function at all without electricity and which might disable perceived important equipment or services. Are they really that important? Do we need to have security cameras monitoring our inner cities to protect us from the moral dissolutes who live there? Is it necessary to wage so many imperial wars abroad, or to wage a war on drugs at home, or wars on illiteracy? How important is it to keep the school system running, or to police our borders against foreign terrorists or illegal immigrants? Do we need to pump huge amounts of water around cities just to stay safe and hygienic? How much energy and creative potential is wasted by people with an emotional commitment to preserving the status quo, when a more rational assessment would admit that the status quo is going to change in many fundamental ways, and a more complete reassessment is necessary for people to behave sensibly? And yes, for most adults, thoughts about money and its importance, its equivalent to strength and power, are, I think, some areas where rethinking is the most necessary. So we're going to conclude the show by returning to David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. We're going to pick up where we left off in Chapter 7. In principle, a wife once possessed owed her husband strict obedience, and often could not seek a divorce even in cases of physical abuse. For women with wealthy or powerful parents, all this remained largely a matter of principle, modified considerably in practice. Merchants' daughters, for example, typically received substantial cash dowries, with which they could go into business in their own right, or act as partners to their husbands. However, for the poor, that is, for most people, marriage came more and more to resemble a simple cash transaction. Some of this must have been an effect of slavery. While actual slaves were fairly numerous, the very existence of a class of people with no kin, who were simple commodities, did make a difference. In Nuzi, for instance, the bride price was paid in domestic animals and silver, amounting to a total value of 40 shekels of silver. To which the author dryly adds, there is some evidence that it was equal to the price of a slave girl. This must have been making things uncomfortably obvious. It's in Nuzi too, where we happen to have unusually detailed records, that we find examples of rich men paying cut-rate bride price to impoverished families to acquire a daughter, whom they then adopt, but who would in fact be either kept as a concubine or nursemaid, or married to one of their slaves. Still, the really crucial factor here was debt. As I pointed out in the last chapter, anthropologists have long emphasized that paying bride wealth is not the same as buying a wife, after all. And this was one of the clinching arguments, remember, in the original 1930s League of Nations debate. If a man were really buying a woman, wouldn't he also be able to sell her? Clearly African and Melanesian husbands were not able to sell their wives to some third party. At most, they could send them home and demand back their bride wealth. A Mesopotamian husband couldn't sell his wife either, or normally he couldn't. Still, everything changed the moment he took out a loan, since, if he did, it was perfectly legal, as we've seen, to use his wife and children as surety, and if he was unable to pay, they could then be taken away as debt pawns in exactly the same way that he could lose slaves, sheep, and goats. What this also meant was that honour and credit became, effectively, the same thing. At least for a poor man, one's credit worthiness was precisely one's command over one's household, and the flip side, as it were. Relations of domestic authority, relations that, in principle, meant ones of care and protection, became property rights that could indeed be bought and sold. Again, for the poor, this meant that family members became commodities that could be rented or sold. Not only could one dispose of one's daughters as brides to work in rich men's households, tablets in Nuzi show that one could now hire out family members simply by taking out a loan. There are recorded cases of men sending their sons or even wives as pawns for loans that were clearly just advance payment for employment in the lender's farm or cloth workshop. The most dramatic and enduring crisis centered on prostitution. It's not entirely clear from the earliest sources whether one can speak here of prostitution at all. Sumerian temples do often appear to have hosted a variety of sexual activities. Some priestesses, for instance, were considered to be married to or otherwise dedicated to gods. What this meant in practice seems to have varied considerably. Much as in the case of the later Devadashis, or temple dancers of Hindu India, some remained celibate. Others were permitted to marry, but were not to bear children. Others were apparently expected to find wealthy patrons, becoming in effect courtesans to the elite. Still others lived in the temples and had the responsibility to make themselves sexually available to worshippers on certain ritual occasions. One thing the early texts do make clear is that all such women were considered extraordinarily important. In a very real sense, they were the ultimate embodiments of civilization. After all, the entire machinery of the Sumerian economy ostensibly existed to support the temples, which were considered the households of the gods. As such, they represented the ultimate possible refinement in everything, from music and dance to art, cuisine, and the graciousness of living. Temple priestesses and spouses of the gods were the highest human incarnations of this perfect life. It's also important to emphasize that Sumerian men do not appear, at least in this earliest period, to have seen anything troubling about the idea that of their sisters having sex for money. To the contrary, insofar as prostitution did occur, and remember, it cannot have been nearly so impersonal, cold cash a relation in a credit economy, Sumerian religious texts identify it as among the fundamental features of human civilization, a gift given by the gods at the dawn of time. Procreative sex was considered natural. After all, animals did it. Non-procreative sex, sex for pleasure, was divine. The most famous expression of this identification of prostitute and civilization can be found in the story of Enkidu, in the Epic of Gilgamesh. In the beginning of the story, Enkidu is a monster, a naked and ferocious wild man who grazes with the gazelles, drinks at the watering place with wild cattle, and terrorizes the people of the city. Unable to defeat him, the citizens finally send out a courtesan, who is a priestess of the goddess Ishtar. She strips before him, and they make love for 6 days and 7 nights. Afterward, Enkidu's animal companions run away from him. After she explains that she has now learned wisdom and become like a god, she is, after all, a divine consort, he agrees to put on clothing and come and live in the city like a proper, civilized human being. Already, in the earliest version of the Enkidu story, though, one could detect a certain ambivalence. Much later, Enkidu is sentenced to death by the gods, and his immediate reaction is to condemn the courtesan for having brought him from the wilds in the first place. He curses her to become a common streetwalker or tavern keeper, living among vomiting drunks, abused and beaten by her clients. Then, later, he regrets his behavior and blesses her instead. But that trace of ambivalence was there from the beginning, and over time it grew more powerful. From early times, Sumerian and Babylonian temple complexes were surrounded by far less glamorous providers of sexual services. Indeed, by the time we know much about them, they were the center of veritable red light districts full of taverns with dancing girls, men in drag, some of them slaves, some runaways, and an almost infinite variety of prostitutes. There is an endlessly elaborate terminology whose subtleties are long since lost to us. Most seem to have doubled as entertainers. Tavern keepers doubled as musicians. Male transvestites were not only singers and dancers, but often performed knife-throwing acts. Many were slaves put to work by their masters, or women working off religious vows or debts, or debt bondswomen, or, for that matter, women escaping from debt bondage with no place else to go. Over time, many of the lower-ranking temple women were either brought as slaves or debt peons as well, and there might often have been a blurring of the roles between priestesses, who performed erotic rituals, and prostitutes owned by the temple, and hence in principle by the god, sometimes lodged within the temple compound itself, whose earnings added to the temple treasuries. Since most everyday transactions in Mesopotamia were not cash transactions, one has to assume that it was the same with prostitutes. Like the tavern keepers, many of whom seem to have been former prostitutes, they developed ongoing credit relations with their clients. And this must have meant that most were less like what we think of as streetwalkers and more like courtesans. Still, the origins of commercial prostitution appear to have been caught up in a peculiar mix of sacred, or once sacred, practice, commerce, slavery, and debt. Patriarchy originated first and foremost in a rejection of the great urban civilizations in the name of a kind of purity, reassertion of paternal control, against great cities like Uruk, Lagash, and Babylon, seen as places of bureaucrats, traders, and whores. The pastoral fringes, the deserts, and the steppes away from the river valleys were the places to which the displaced, indebted farmers fled. Resistance in the ancient Middle East was always less a politics of rebellion than a politics of exodus, of melting away with one's flocks and families, often before both were taken away. There were always tribal people living on the fringes. During good times, they began to take to the cities. In hard times, their numbers swelled with refugees, farmers who effectively became Enkidu once again. Then, periodically, they would create their own alliances and sweep back into the cities once again as conquerors. It's difficult to say precisely how they imagined their situation, because it's only in the Old Testament, written on the other side of the Fertile Crescent, that one has any record of the pastoral rebels' point of view. But nothing there mitigates against the suggestion that the extraordinary emphasis we find there on the absolute authority of fathers and the jealous protection of their fickle womenfolk were made possible by, but at the same time a protest against, this very commoditization of people in the cities that they had fled. The world's holy books, the Old and New Testaments, the Quran, religious literature from the Middle Ages to this day, echo this voice of rebellion, combining contempt for that corrupt urban life, suspicion of the merchant, and often intense misogyny. One need only think of the image of Babylon itself, which has become permanently lodged in the collective imagination, as not only the cradle of civilization, but also the place of whores. Herodotus echoed popular Greek fantasies when he claimed that every Babylonian maiden was obliged to prostitute herself at the temple so as to raise the money for her dowry. In the New Testament, St. Peter often referred to Rome as Babylon, and the book of Revelation provides perhaps the most vivid image of what he meant by this when it speaks of Babylon the Great Whore sitting upon a scarlet-coloured beast full of names of blasphemy. Quote, "And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth." Unquote. Such is the voice of patriarchal hatred of the city, and of the angry millennial voices of the fathers of the ancient poor. Patriarchy, as we know it, seems to have taken shape in a seesawing battle between the newfound elites and the newly dispossessed. Much of my own analysis here is inspired by the brilliant work of feminist historian Gerda Lerner, who, in an essay on the origins of prostitution, observed, quote, "Another source for the commercial prostitution was the pauperization of farmers and their increasing dependence on loans in order to survive periods of famine, which led up to debt slavery. Children of both sexes were given up for debt pledges or sold for adoption. Out of such practices, the prostitution of female family members for the benefit of the head of the family could readily develop. Women might end up as prostitutes because their parents had to sell them into slavery, or because their impoverished husbands might so use them, or they might become self-employed as a last alternative to enslavement. With luck, they might in this profession be upwardly mobile through becoming concubines. By the middle of the second millennium BC, prostitution was well established as a likely occupation for the daughters of the poor. As the sexual regulation of the women of the propertied class became more firmly entrenched, the virginity of respectable daughters became a financial asset for the family. Thus, commercial prostitution came to be seen as a social necessity for meeting the sexual needs of men. What remained problematic was how to distinguish clearly and permanently between respectable and non-respectable women." Unquote. This last point is crucial. The most dramatic known attempt to solve the problem, Lerner observes, can be found in a Middle Assyrian law code from somewhere between 1400 and 1100 BC, which is also the first known reference to veiling in the history of the Middle East, and also, Lerner emphasizes, first to make the policing of social boundaries the responsibility of the state.
And that thin end of a very, very long wedge of government control over individual lives is where we're going to leave David Graeber this week. If you're interested in meeting up with other Unwelcome Guest listeners and exchanging ideas, let me know when will be a good time for you to contact each other over the internet. If you're interested to download this or any of our 586 previous shows, you can do so from our website at unwelcomeguests.net/archive.
There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep good.